and welcome to the Kids Planet podcast.
An opportunity to explore the highs and lows of raising under fives. Here are your hosts from the Kids Planet marketing team.
Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Murphy and I'm joined today by Cheryl Warren from Aperion, Zend Training and Consultancy, to take a close look at neurodiversity in early years. So welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you very much for having me, Sarah. I'm delighted to be here.
Great to have you on. So you've been a trainer and consultant in the kind of SEND field for 30 years now. Do you want to give a bit of a background of your story?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've been doing the SEND stuff for about three, but within the early years sector, it's been 30 years, which sounds forever, and it feels like forever some days, to be honest. I always wanted to work in early years. It's all I ever wanted to do. And I wanted to be a nanny predominantly. That was my dream growing up.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a nanny and I was fortunate enough to start my career that way. So I'm NNEB. So that was the level three qualification back in the day, the only one available. And that's what I chose to do and wanted to do at college when I left school. And they've done a variety of different things. So I started out as a nanny, then went into working within family centres. So working with very vulnerable families, children who'd been abused, children in foster care, children with special educational needs, and also children with quite complex needs too. And then I've sort of then moved on to local authority and was a development officer for a long, long time. I've been within settings as a quality and compliance officer, SENCO, lead SENCO. I've been a trainer and an assessor, a lecturer within a college, lots and lots of different things.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, it's all kind of led me to where I am today, which kind of has, yes, both my professional side, but also personal side. Both of my children are neurodivergent. And so I'm very much... people talk about their lived experiences, and I kind of say, well, they're my living experiences because my children are still here and I'm still having to advocate and support them through, you know, through their journey and navigating life with a neurodivergent brain in a neurotypical world. I now am really fortunate in what I do. I absolutely adore what I do. I'm working with predominantly nursery groups up and down the UK in ensuring that our early years educators, our primary educators, have a real in-depth knowledge and understanding of neurodiversity affirming practice, which ultimately means really understanding our children's differences. And to by having that understanding, we're therefore able to support better and accept our children for who they are and provide spaces where they can thrive. So yeah, it's fascinating. I'm meeting different people, different children. There are days when I can be standing in front of 200 people in a conference speaking about it. And then the next day I'm in a setting being covered in flour and slime and all sorts of stuff actually within the nurseries and with the children themselves. So I love what I do and feel really fortunate with what I do.
Brilliant. And what does, going back to basics, what does neurodiversity mean?
So yeah, we kind of get a bit unsure still, I think, with the terminology. So neurodiversity is the differences in brain functionality. So we would have a group of children, say you're working in toddler room or preschool, your group of 24 children are neurodiverse. So as a collective, we are, that group of children are neurodiverse. They're going to think differently, learn differently, respond to situations differently. So neuro being brain, diverse being difference. So it's the differences in brain functionality. And then, so neurodiversity is the sort of umbrella term. But then under neurodiversity, you have those children, those adults that are neurodivergent. So those individuals who are following a different pathway of brain development. So we would be considering those who are neurodivergent are those children that are showing us emerging traits of, or who have confirmation of a brain difference. So autism, ADHD, PDA, sensory processing differences, dyslexia, dyscalculia, dyspraxia, those kind of things. So neurodiversity as the whole, some of us are neurodivergent, and then there are others under that umbrella who are neurotypical. So those who are following the typical trajectory of brain development. So those children that aren't necessarily going to be talked about with regards to their personal development, social development, emotional development, communication development with Yasenko. So those children that are following that typical trajectory, that typical pathway of brain development. So yeah, neurodiverse. So an individual is not neurodiverse. An individual is neurodivergent. Neurodiversity is the whole.
I see.
Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned neurodiversity affirming practice, which I know you're an advocate for. Could you explain more about what this is and what it means to be a neuroaffirming educator?
Yeah, absolutely. So to be neurodiversity affirming, it's basically affirming. The word affirm is to declare one's support for. So we are basically saying that for all of these children in my room, whether they are neurodivergent or they are neurotypical, we are going to affirm your neurotype. So with a specific focus on our neurodivergent children, it's about saying, do you know what? I am going to be that educator behind you, waving the pom-poms, blowing the trumpets, waving the flags and saying, I am going to support you for exactly who you are, how you are, who you are, how you behave, how you respond to situations, how you play. And it's saying, it's not, and people kind of say to me, oh, Cheryl, you know, does this mean that, you know, the neurodivergent children that we have, the behaviors that we're seeing, we let them do what they want when they want? No, it's not. It's about understanding where that behavior comes from and understanding and knowing your children, knowing their sensory differences, understanding those sensory differences, understanding their different play needs, their different communication styles, and going, we get it. I'm going to be that curious educator because I'm going to see this behavior, see this difference in the play, and I'm going to affirm and support you with it. So yes, I'm going to stop the behaviors that might be hurting other children or breaking materials or whatever it might be. But I know that I need to give you something to replace what you're getting from doing that. So it's understanding those sensory differences. And being neurodiversity affirming is really supporting this strength-based narrative. I don't want to go into a setting, and as a parent, I don't want to hear from my child's key person that whole long list of things that they can't do. I want to hear what our children can do. So it's that strength-based narrative, and shifting our narrative with, you know, they can't do this, they can't do that, they can't do this, but look at what they have achieved today. Look at what they can do, because I understand that that child, you know, throwing that ball at their friend that's hitting their leg, I know that that's something that we might need to give them an alternative to, because they might be hurting their friend while they're throwing that ball. But actually, what I'm identifying is that child really trying to seek connection with that other child. So it's viewing our children through this different lens, this lens of a positive, strength-based narrative. And it's also understanding, being neurodiversity affirming is understanding the rights of our children as well. You know, we all know about the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, those articles that as a nation we've signed up to. You know, every child has the right to an education, every child has the right to play, every child has the right to an identity. But that is every child. So every child has the right to play. And neurodivergent children play differently. but it's understanding that that difference is okay. Mm-hmm. And we need to join our children in that play, not stop them doing that play because we need them to come and do something else, or we need to sign this off on the early years foundation stage or whatever it might be. It's knowing that that repetitive play, that over and over again play, that sensory seeking play, that schematic play is that child's play preference, and they have a right to that play. And it's also that right to an identity. You know, all of our children have a right to an identity, and our children's neurotype is part of that identity. So it's not putting in interventions or getting them to change who they are, because what you're doing then is removing part of their identity. Their neurodivergence, their autism, their ADHD, their PDA, their dyslexia is part of who they are. So it's about understanding and affirming and allowing for that child to be who they are. Because if you're allowing that child to be who they are and knowing what that comes with, that enables you to provide a real sense of belonging for that child. And belonging and connection is key to being that neurodiversity affirming educator.
Definitely. So it's kind of accepting and adapting to their differences, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And knowing what we need to do as the educator, the child hasn't got to change to fit in with us.
No.
We need to join that child where they are.
How do we identify children who are neurodivergent?
There's a whole range of things that, you know, it's called the autistic spectrum for a reason. There's, you know, there's lots of different elements. And it's looking at... it's looking at the bigger picture. So it's not just, oh my gosh, the child can't sit still, they must be ADHD. Oh gosh, the child's lining their cars up, they must be autistic. We've got to build a bigger picture. So it's all about that initial evidence gathering right from the get-go. So part of that evidence gathering is having really deep and meaningful conversations and connections with the child's parents. How are things at home? How is the child responding when they get home from nursery? How are they when they are out in social situations? What's life like when you're doing the weekly shopping in Tesco's? You know, what about the hand dryers in the public toilets? What about different smells? What about if you have to change routine at a moment's notice? How is the child responding to that at home? And then let's look at their play. Let's look at how they're interacting and engaging with the environment. Let's have a look at how they're interacting and engaging and connecting with their peers. Let's have a look at their communication preferences, because, you know, we might identify a child who is pre-verbal, but we also might have very articulate children at 2, 2.5 that could also be neurodivergent. So we've got to build the bigger picture. Yes, there are some common indicators, there are some common traits, but they will present very differently for our children. So, like I say, understand those differences in their behavioral responses to the situations they're in, to transitions, to the routine. How are they playing? How are they, what sensory differences are you picking up? 95% of our autistic children have sensory differences. So it's quite often the sort of early indicators for us. What are they able to manage and cope with in the environment? How do different smells, different things they're expected to touch or feel? What about how the environment, how busy the environment is, how loud it is? How does that respond to how does the child respond to that? Mm. But then those additional sensory systems, you know, are we seeing children spinning and seeking sensory input through touch their need for, you know, if they're wanting rough and tumble play or lots of roly polies or spinning round and round and round. Mm-hmm. What are they eating? What differences are you seeing in the food that they're preferring to eat? It's about gathering the evidence that looks at the child as a whole, not just one specific thing that we kind of see in a checklist for, you know, autistic behaviors. They don't show us any eye contact. They must be autistic. We've got to look at the bigger picture and really understand the nuances too, because, you know, we often hear children masking, don't we? Well, we don't see that at nursery. The parent is describing this behavior at home, but we're not seeing that in nursery. But if you look deep enough and you really know your children, you are going to see it. So it's really about being that detective. And if you're getting information from the key person or you're getting information from the parent, start to dig deep with what you're observing within the nursery to build that picture.
Definitely. Okay, so if a parent says, I don't know what to do, I'm worried about my child's development, what would be the first kind of port of call action-wise?
So if you've got a parent that's coming to you because they've identified these behaviours at home, the first thing I would say is that we need to create a relationship with that parent, mm-hmm. where that parent feels that they can talk to us and they're not going to be judged or criticised or kind of pushed away or gaslighted from us. It's kind of, I hear you. Thank you for sharing this with me. Let's dig deeper together. So I would be arranging a meeting in a safe space at a time that's convenient for that parent and kind of go, right, talk me through life at home. Mm. What's going on? Like I say, without judgment or without critique, how does the child sleep? What are they eating at home? What have you identified at home? And if you started to identify some of those things in nursery too, then validate what that parent is saying by sharing that with them in that moment. Yeah, actually, we've noticed that their behavior changes at the moment of transition. That really sounds like things are for you at home. Okay, let's have a discussion and let's have a think about some adaptions and some accommodations that we can put in place. We can do X, Y, and Z here at nursery, and we can support you in maybe trying these strategies at home too. So let's see how that goes. Let's have a catch up again in maybe a couple of weeks' time. Let's see if that's had an impact here and we've noticed a difference and we've provided those accommodations and adaptions and we're not now necessarily seeing the high level meltdowns that we were seeing before. Let's see if that helps. Mm-hmm. And then we start to have deeper level conversations. We might then start to create a bit of an action plan. Certainly start to have a think about the SEN code of practice and the graduated approach in terms of assess, plan, do, review. Let's start to put these things in place. Let's build this picture. Let's provide regular opportunities for contact with that parent, where again, that parent feels that this is a safe space to open up, maybe about some of the challenges that they're finding at home. And then if the parent is then, with you in that journey and accepting of those conversations, then it may well be, depending on what's being noted and observed in nursery and what's being noted and observed at home, let's now have those conversations about whether or not we need to bring in those additional professionals. Or actually, is what we're doing in nursery and the accommodations and adaptions and that ordinarily available provision we can provide in nursery, let's see if that supports the child for now. But then also start to be thinking, okay, so how much longer is a child going to be with us? Are they going to be moving on in terms of the next stage of their journey? Do we need to start referrals or further assessments to go down that kind of EHCP route? But conversations with parents is all about that relationship, because as well as those parents that come to you and say, I've seen this at home, I want to have a conversation, we will also have those parents that we want to have conversations with, and those parents are not yet there on their journey to really have that conversation yet. But both of those parents, it's providing that trusted relationship, that connection that comes with no judgment, that comes with no criticism, that comes with no blame, where we can create a safe space for our parents to talk to us and have that conversation with us when they're ready.
Yeah. And you mentioned about opening up, because obviously for a lot of parents, it's quite an emotional journey. What kind of advice would you have on working through that initial journey of discovery to acceptance?
Trust me, it's a very emotional one. I'm still living it right now. Yeah. It is. And we go through a real range of emotions as parents. I'll often hear, parents are in denial, so we can't have that conversation. We can't make that referral. I put out a podcast episode myself this week. We're not in denial. I knew my son was autistic at 2.5, but I did not want to say it out loud. It was scary. It frightened me. And if anybody was going to approach me at that moment, I would have pushed them away. I really would. But what I needed in that moment was a kind of tribe around me, almost, of people that I knew that when I was ready to have that conversation, I could openly and freely talk about it, knowing that I wasn't going to be gaslighted or pushed away or criticized for it. You know, we have parents who, you know, they might be putting their child in front of the iPad to eat their dinner. But if the only way as a parent, you know, that you're going to get some nutrients in your child, the only way you can do that is by putting the iPad in front of them, then that is what you're going to do. But don't blame me for that. Don't criticize me for that. Know that that's what I need to do, because food in my child's belly is really important. And it's really, you know, we know the importance of nutrition and for growth and brain development and all of those things. So don't criticize me for it. But just provide that space. And sometimes, you know what, sometimes it's not even about a conversation about my child and my child's needs. Sometimes I just want to have a conversation with somebody about what I did at the weekend,
yeah,
about something other than my children, because it can be too much sometimes. And actually, just call me in if you're seeing that, you know, and I'll often say, if you see a parent drop off, it could be that you just go to them and say, oh, I really need a coffee. I haven't had one yet this morning. Fancy one? Fancy a coffee? What did you get up to at the weekend? Oh, I remember you telling me that you were going to go and watch that new film that came out at the weekend, or that Netflix documentary. Have you watched it yet? Fancy going in, having a cuppa and having a conversation around it. Bring the biscuits out.
Yeah.
Talk about something other than their child or their child's progress or, you know, developmental differences that you've seen. It's about developing your relationship. So as well as, you know, I said at the beginning about being a neurodiversity affirming educator is providing that sense of belonging and acceptance and connection. In order to support our children to thrive, we need to support the whole family to thrive. So we need to provide that opportunity for parents to that belonging, that connection, and that creating that safe space is really, really important for parents too. So just approach those parents, work with those parents, engage with those parents, connect with those parents from a space of understanding and empathy, connection and belonging.
Brilliant. And what other support is available for families?
It depends where you live. And I know that sounds awful, but quite often it is a bit of a postcode lottery. Part of our role within early years, certainly that SENCO role, is to really understand that local offer. Mm-hmm. So under the SEN code of practice, you know, every local authority has to provide this local offer of local provision for parents of children with special educational needs and disabilities. So we need to start understanding what is available locally and the services that are available locally. For me, it's finding those services and those people that are aware of and understand those different neurotypes. So whether it's a local support group for parents of children with ADHD or parents of children with PDA or autism, I found a lot of comfort in my local National Autistic Society group, just a group on Facebook that were other parents in the same position that I was in. And it just provided that comfort and that reassurance that it wasn't just me. So as well as local services, national services, find out about those small parenting groups, parenting supports, and those things that are out there. Understand the role of occupational therapists, understand the role of speech and language therapists, understanding what services parents can reach where they're not having to wait 3 years because of waiting lists, you know, what private services are available. I know not every parent is necessarily going to be able to access those, but there are those available and there are funding streams available too. I mean, I know when I found out and we got the diagnosis for my oldest son, I was given a pile of leaflets. Off you go. Thank you for coming.
Oh, really?
That was no help to me whatsoever. And actually, it was my neighbour that I went to. It was just a chance conversation with my neighbour, who I knew anyway. But I just broke down in front of her and I said, what on earth do I do now? And she literally went through with me the local services, the funding, the financial support that was available to me as a parent, the things that I could draw down, you know, disability living allowance. I didn't even think that was something that I could access. But it was that helped me to fund his occupational therapy and the OT and the assessment route that we went down to discover more about his sensory processing differences. Without that, I wouldn't have been able to fund those things. So understand what's available locally for your parents, and even down to things like the advocacy services, CENDIAS, and all of those things that can support parents in meetings with other professionals. And you know even if you've got a parent within your nursery who has a toddler or preschooler going through the process, but also maybe has a child in school who has been diagnosed neurodivergent, but school aren't necessarily listening or being supportive, and you're wanting to have those meetings with the school-based SENCO, well, you can get those representatives from CENDIAS to support that. So again, it's not always about supporting the child that you have. Sometimes it's about supporting the whole family, which can also include those older siblings. So really understand what's available locally.
Yeah.
Understand what funding opportunities that are available and what you know, financial packages are available, and trying to signpost and try to link up to a real variety of services for parents. But that comes with understanding your local offer, and you know, certainly a SENCO, I will always advocate for, you know, knowing what is available in your area. Go and visit some of the groups, go and visit some of the play schemes or the play and stay sessions or the OTs. Build those relationships with those local professionals so that you really understand what they do, what's available, so that signposting can be really effective.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Something that you mentioned before, which I wanted to touch back on, which was interesting, is how you said neurodivergent children play differently. Do you have specific kind of examples of this?
Yeah, absolutely. They do. You know, the kind of common one is well, they just line things up. They do, because for a lot of our children, one of the play types, one of the play preferences could be categorizing and organizing, and that comes out in their play. Our children have, you know, are engaged in schema play. So those trajectory schemas or those enveloping schemas will be, for some children, can be really, really detailed and really involved. So understand those different play types. It's joining our children in that play. It's not get your children to play with something else. I was speaking at a conference where a lady said to me that one of her children had a real special interest in the slide, and all this little boy did was go up and down the slide, and they'd do that for hours and hours and hours. And she was given some advice to remove the slide to get the child to play with something else. And I was horrified. And I said, please do not remove the slide. We need to join the child in understanding what it is about the slide that they're enjoying. So I would be, if the child's just going up and down the slide, I would, if the slide allowed, it was big enough, I'd be going up and down the slide with them. I would be bringing other objects to the slide. I'd be looking at, you know, materials that could go down the slide, that might go down the slide really slowly, or cars or balls that might roll down the slide really, really fast. I might bring a jug of water. I might put some glitter in the water that I can roll down the slide, showing the child that I love the slide. I'm going to validate what you're doing with the slide, but offer some differences too. Look at what we can do as well all around the slide. Could we lay the slide on its side? Could we walk around the side of it, you know, balance on it? Could we bring some blankets or some materials, to make it into a den, use that special interest to engage the child in their preferred play, but validate the way that they play by joining in with them. And again, it goes back to that neurodiversity affirming practice, affirming their play. It's not remove the slide because we need to see you play with a sand tray or play in the role play area. It's going, do you know what? I love the play, the way that you play with the slide. I understand the fact that this is your special interest. So I am going to come and join you right where you are, and I am going to follow your lead. But I might just then also bring some other things to offer a different perspective for you, to offer some additional challenge for you. The child might not want to know, and that's fine. But let's offer some differences. Let's offer some alternatives. But validate the child's play. So sensory seeking play, schema play, over and over again play, special interest play. You know, my son had special interests in special interest in the Cold War and in flags.
Oh, wow.
Well, he's now, for his history GCSE, one of the subjects was Cold War. Well, he smashed his GCSE because that was his special interest. And he's now doing it A-level and really thriving. So it's not to shun or, you know, poo-poo our children's differences in play. It's understanding that that difference is okay, and join them where they are and validate the way that they play and actually build a connection and trust through that play. And it's vital that we do that.
Yeah. And we talk a lot in early years and education as a whole about enabling and inclusive environments. So that kind of touches on that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I can guarantee, you know, I haven't looked at, the nursery website, but I can guarantee that in that nursery website, in any show around, in any of the nurseries, a member of staff will say, we follow the children's interests. Mm. We plan based on the children's interests. Well, if our neurodivergent child's interest is the slide, why would we remove it? Mm. Why would we not plan around the slide? We offer that and we provide that for our neurotypical children. So why on earth are we doing something different for our neurodivergent children and we're taking that away from them? Let's offer the same to our neurodivergent children as we do our neurotypical children. If our narrative is that we plan for our children's interests, we follow their interests, we follow their lead, we set up all of these activities because of that interest, well, we don't not do it because the child's autistic. We should be doing it as well. Their interests are just as valid as our neurotypical children's interests. So let's do it for them too.
Definitely. And we've been doing kind of send outdoor trips as well, which enables the children to really immerse themselves in nature, which is a big thing at Kids Planet, be their authentic selves. What do you think are the benefits of getting outdoors for neurodivergent children? I mean, obviously for all children.
Yeah, for all children, for sure. You know, we understood the importance of being outside, didn't we, during COVID? You know, that was the one Definitely. Thing we could do, go out for a walk in nature. It's important for our well-being. It's important for our mental health. And the same applies for our neurodivergent children. You know, physical activity, physical movement creates alertness. And for our neurodivergent children, many of whom who have these sensory differences, being outside, being physical, actually helps to calm the areas of our brain that are hyper alert, over alert. But it also helps our brains to wake up the bits that are not so alert. So being outside offers our children space. It offers our children the opportunity to have space around them, but it also means that there is less pressure. When you are outside, when a group of children are playing outside, there is less pressure to conform. There is less pressure to talk. There is less pressure to engage with others in this confined space. So being outdoors is vital. I do not understand when I go into nursery settings and they are on the ground floor, they've got a toddler room or a preschool room on the ground floor and they've got a door, directly out to their outdoor space. And they talk about the child's behaviour and they talk about the child being overwhelmed when the room gets too noisy or too busy. Put the door shut because it's too cold outside. So we have the door shut, or it's not their time to be outside. Wherever you can, we need to have free flow. You open that door, it immediately reduces the noise level, reduces the overwhelm, reduces the busyness inside. So being outside offers space, less pressure, reduces the noise, and therefore reduces the sensory stresses on our children. What it also does, research tells us that it improves our children's motor skills and cognition as well, certainly in our children, our preschool children. And just being outside, it helps us feel better. It releases those positive hormones, the dopamine, all of those endorphins that are imperative for our mental health and our well-being. So I will always advocate for children to be outside, to experience the outdoors, because it does, it just offers that completely different experience and removes so many of those stresses that we place on our children when they're inside.
Yeah, definitely. So it might be nice actually to ask you a couple of questions from parents, if that would be okay.
Yeah, go for it.
So one concern raised by a parent was about questioning kind of what they've done wrong or what they're doing wrong as a parent when their child seems to be coping or masking away from home. What would your kind of advice be for this?
Mum guilt is a great thing, isn't it? We feel guilty for doing, we feel guilty for not doing. The first thing I will say is that as a parent, you have done nothing wrong. You have done absolutely nothing wrong. And the fact that this parent is talking about masking and seeing the differences in their child means that they have gone some way to understanding the differences that their child is presenting, which means that you want to do the best that you can for your child. So you have done nothing wrong. This is the situation that you're in. This is the beautiful, wonderful, unique child that you have in front of you. And you've done nothing wrong. What we find is that the meltdowns, the explosive behaviours that we see are from children who feel safe enough to show you that side.
That's true.
So actually, a child masking is hiding who they are to fit in. And if our children are fitting in, there is not that sense of belonging and connection. So where the child then is, and I've had it with both of my children actually, they mask at school, because that's where my children are now. They are 16 and 10. They are masking at school. They are complying. They are hiding who they are. They are doing everything that they can to fit in. They're hiding their stims and their sensory seeking behaviors. They are hiding and concealing all of that. And then when my children come home, they explode. It's a bit like we call it the Coke bottle effect. So if you imagine a bottle of Coke being shaken up all day, the stress is building and building and building, but it's contained in that bottle. The bubbles are building. But when they get home, the lid comes off and that stress has to go somewhere. So they explode because they feel safe at home. I know that doesn't help when your child is screaming and shouting and punching you, but know that the child is doing that with you because they feel safe enough that you are going to be there to support them in that level of high anxiety and high stress. And what you are doing, actually, you've provided that safe space at home in order for them to do that. So you haven't done anything wrong. What I would say is that we need to bring together the child at school or nursery and the child at home. So we need to have that open dialogue with the child educators to know that this is what's happening. So therefore, let's have a conversation about why that child is masking and what that looks like. Mm. We need, as I said at the beginning, we need to build this holistic picture of our child. And by doing that, we need to understand that child in varying different situations. So you haven't done anything wrong. What I would recommend, I'm just gathering it from the pile of books in front of me, I would recommend to that parent getting a copy of a book called Your Safe Space, Creating a Home Where Autistic Children Thrive. It's by an amazing lady called Jo Gaunt, G-A-U-N-T. And I've actually interviewed her for my podcast. And she is a neurodivergent mum, also mm-hmm. raising neurodivergent children. She has four of them. And she talks in her book about her story and how she has provided this safe space at home for her child. And she talks lots about those meltdowns. And she talks about the strategies that you can use at home. And some of those, you know, before I even discovered lots of things about my son, it's about structure, it's about routine, it's about familiarity, it's about visuals, it's about support during transitions, it's mm-hmm. about support before we go out on a trip or go and see a family member, it's the planning and preparation, all of those things that we can do at home to provide that safe space at home. Please, you have not done anything wrong. You really haven't.
Oh, that's really reassuring. So another worry from a parent was about eating, which I know we did touch on a little bit earlier, and how restricted their child's diet is. So they've seen a dietitian, but the advice was let him eat what he wants and when he wants, really. Yeah. However, the parent was wondering how to manage this when all he's willing to eat is crisps at home. He did used to eat toast and Belvita oats, but now won't eat these. What would kind of be your approach?
It's such a tricky one, isn't it? Because yeah. food is really emotive. And if you think about your children, food is one of the few things that our children have control over in their lives. Mm. So when everything in that child's life feels out of control, they're trying to seek some autonomy. They're trying to seek some choice, some things that they can make the decision on. And what goes in their mouth and what comes out is something they can control. Mm. And it's also something that's really emotive for us as parents, because all we want to do is make sure that our children are having the right foods, the right nutrients, are growing. You know, we want to have those wonderful experiences at the restaurant or, you know, picnics or, you know, we're recording this in November, you know, Christmas lunch all together as a family. We want all of that. Of course we do. The fears that you have as a parent, the anxiety you're feeling as a parent around food and around mealtimes can be felt by our children. Mm. And what can happen if we're placing pressure on our children to try these new foods, to eat these new foods, it can shift into eating disorders and lots and lots of you know, deeper level challenges. So one thing I want to say, first of all, is that I get it. Mm. I understand it. I have a 16-year-old who still will only eat the same foods. He has had, well, he started school at 5. He's now 16. He's doing A-levels. He still has the same lunch in that lunchbox that every single day. Mm. Routine becomes really important for our children around food and for the majority of our food. So the crisps and the rice cakes are safe foods, and they're safe foods because they're predictable foods. If you think about, you know, if your child's preference, their safe food is Tesco's salt and vinegar crisps. Every time they open one of those packets, every one of those crisps looks the same, smells the same, tastes the same, crunches the same. It's predictable. Mm. It's safe. So when your child has sensory processing differences, they need that same predictable food because it's not going to cause overwhelm or anxiety. So that's where it's coming from, that sensory processing difference and that need for that sensory input and that familiarity around food. When we are, though, shifting into food restrictions, where children, that's what they will only eat, then I would always recommend referrals and conversations with a dietitian, because there is the potential that a child will be missing those key nutrients. So many children, many families that I've worked with over the past few years will have milk being given to them that is high level nutrients. So the child will need to have those, you know, those little shakes or, you know, that milk to make sure that they're getting those nutrients. And those nutritionists and pediatricians can really support with that. With regards to every single day, I will always still offer the child the food that the rest of the family are having. But what I would do is put that food on a plate in very small amounts. It might just be, you know, one forkful of, you know, one bit of chicken breast that would be enough for one mouthful, or two peas, or two bits of pasta. And I would put them on a plate where they're not touching each other. Yep. So they're separate. And I would still place that in front of the child. You know, if you're having chicken breast, peas and pasta for tea, but you're having a sauce or you're having gravy or whatever, just put that on a plate for a child and have them still join in that experience at the mealtime, at the table, and offer that to them. But I would also offer alongside a plate with those crisps and with those rice cakes. So we're not saying try that food first, then you can have your safe food, because it's not that our children won't eat the chicken, the peas and the pasta. They can't. Everything in their body is telling them that that's unsafe. They can't eat it, but at least offer it still to them, because there might be that one day where they might poke the food around with their fork. They might touch it with their finger. They might smell it. That then eventually that might then end up just being licked, and then it might end up going in the mouth. But don't put the pressure on them to eat it when they're not ready. So provide that food, take away the sauces, take away the big pile of food, offer that food separately while still providing them with their safe foods, and introduce different foods all the time. But don't think, you know, quite often we read the books, don't we? Put the fruit into a smiley face, or make fruit kebabs with the children. They're more likely to eat it if they've been involved in preparing it. But that's not always the case for our children because of their sensory differences. Take the pressure off. Take the stress away from yourself as a parent. Get in contact with nutritionists and pediatricians if you think actually your child's now, you know, in terms of children that are constipated or things like that, because they're not getting the right nutrients, then we need to potentially go down, you know, those conversations with medical teams. But take the pressure off and offer that food in different formats, but still understand why they need their safe foods.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I'll just ask one more question then. So this is from a nursery manager on how do they support neurodivergent staff?
Yes. Because neurodivergent children become neurodivergent adults. We forget that sometimes. And we will have amazing, wonderful neurodivergent staff. What we also need to be aware of, though, is that we might have some very young staff who are just discovering elements of their own neurotype and their own neuroidentity through the work that they're doing with the children in the nursery.
Yeah.
So we need to make sure that we are ready for those conversations where members of staff are on that road of self-discovery themselves, and providing empathy and understanding for how scary that might feel for them. And offer, again, offer your time, connection with them in that moment. But if you have a member of staff that is with you and is very open and talking to you lots about their different neurotype, then I would be having those conversations with them. Whereas we're doing a kind of observations for discovery to learning about our children, you know, we've got an adult there that is willing to have that conversation with us and tell us. So I'd want to know what their sensory differences are, what accommodations and adaptations could be put in place to support them to thrive in your setting. Do they need regular breaks themselves? Mm. Where's the best place for them to take the lunch break? Does the staff room work for them, or is it too busy, too noisy, too smelly? Where could they go to decompress, to regulate, to prepare themselves ready for the afternoon session? Is talking to parents something that they find really tricky, really overwhelming and really stressful? So could it be that they're always with another adult when they're giving feedback to a parent? If you're having to get them to upload information for assessments or, you know, on an online platform that you use for child observations, how does that work for them? What if they're dyslexic? Is that okay? Do they want, you know, is it a case of management will check over their reports first? Is that member of staff okay with that in terms of spelling or grammar or, you know, whatever? Let's have that open and honest conversation to provide that those accommodations and adaptations. If you are having a staff meeting after work, does that time work for that member of staff? How are they going to be getting home? Are they going to be panicked about what they're going to have to eat because, you know, their preference, again, they might have food preferences and you know, that needs to happen at home. What does that look like? Does going home at a different time of day, is that going to cause them overwhelm, anxiety, because they've now got to get a different train or a different bus? So therefore, they're not going to be able to concentrate in the meeting because they're panicking about how they're going to get home. So let's help them prepare and plan for those differences in the day. If they've got a child who is overwhelmed in the nursery, is that then causing overwhelm and sensory overwhelm for them? So are we able to be a bit flexible and say, do you know what? Okay, yes, you can take 5-10 minutes to go and decompress, to go and, you know, take a walk, because we know that caused you real overwhelm. Come back when you're ready. How flexible are we with our neurodivergent staff? Because if we're not, we're going to lose some amazing people from our workforce. So have that open dialogue. And again, provide that connection and that belonging so that staff member feels able to come and talk to you, that they're, you know, worst case scenario, their job's not at risk because they're asking you for some help and some support. I know staffing is really tricky right now. We're kind of, you know, we're operating on skeleton staff. So to have one pop out of the room for 10 minutes to take a breather, you know, it's kind of that's going to have impact. But actually, if that's providing the support that staff member needs for their mental health and their well-being, actually, you're going to retain that member of staff. Mm. So all of the creating of that safe space for our children, all of those things we're looking at, understanding their sensory needs, understanding their differences, understanding what they need when things are different, understanding their play differences, understanding the accommodations and the adaptations that we need to put in place for our neurodivergent children, we need to do exactly the same for our staff. So again, being a neurodiversity affirming educator for the child, be that neurodiversity affirming colleague and workplace for that member of staff, and have a setting that is an open door policy where they feel safe enough. And again, like with our parents, without judgment, without criticism, where your staff can thrive too.
Absolutely. Yeah, really helpful. And your book, Neurodiversity in Early Years, is coming out. That's next March, is that right?
Next March. I'm hoping March. We're kind of with the publication team at the moment. So we're just kind of going over chapters and looking at, it's very exciting. They keep sending over different front covers for me to have a look at. So yeah, come and join me over on social media and I'll definitely be putting kind of updates and bits and pieces on there. I do have a workbook, an ebook that people can download already that's on my website, that just is a kind of a real kind of starting point, and we'll kind of go into a bit more detail with some of the things that I've been discussing today. So that's available on my website. You can go and grab a copy of that now. But yeah, watch out. And actually, it's Becky Eckersley has provided lots of case studies for my book too. So yes, yeah. You might, some of your listeners might see themselves within my book, which is amazing. I'm really grateful to Becky for that.
Yeah, definitely. Becky's our lead send advisor. So yeah, that's been a really exciting project, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, she's been fantastic and really, really a supporter of what I do an advocate for what I do too. And I know that she's very much kind of aligned with that neurodiversity affirming approach across the nurseries as well. So
totally. Well, brilliant. Just a fun one to end things on then. What three things would you have on a desert island would you take?
Wow. I didn't realise I was on desert island discs. three things on a desert island. Okay. I would probably take with me something that I can play some music on. Because I love listening to music. It really kind of supports whatever mood I'm in. So whether I'm happy or whether I'm sad and lonely and depressed, I definitely need some music with me. Regardless of the fact that I'm on a desert island, it would probably be my onesie.
Okay.
I need to feel comfortable, and so even on a really hot day I will still, my husband will walk around the house in bare feet, and I need things on my feet. I need to feel comfort. So yeah, probably a onesie, and then I'd probably say a scented candle.
Okay.
There will, wherever I am in my desk, I'm always lighting candles with different smells, which yeah, annoy my children sometimes. Like, Mum, what is that smell? I'm like, just leave me alone. It's kind of creating a bit of a zen moment for me. Yeah. So yeah, a scented candle. But then I guess I'd probably have to bring along some matches as well. So that might be four things. But but yeah, music, a onesie and a candle.
I like it. Really good choices. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been really, really informative and interesting. Lots to unpack.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed having the opportunity to chat with you and share a little bit about what I do. So thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. Well, thank you all for listening. Do join us again for another episode of All Things Early Years.
Thanks for joining us and to our guest today. Tune in next month. And in the meantime, pop over to our website and follow us on social media.
Kids Planet, working together to inspire your world.